Welcome to Civil Discourse. This podcast will use government documents to illuminate the workings of the American government and offer context around the effects of government agencies in your everyday life. And now your hosts, Nia Rogers, Public Affairs Librarian, and Dr. John Augenbaugh, Political Science Professor.
Hey, Augie.
Good morning, Nia. How are you?
I'm excellent. How are you?
I'm doing lovely. Thank you very much.
How much coffee have you had today?
I've already had a full pot, when the podcast is over with, I will be brewing my second for the day.
I watched a 60 Minutes episode where they talked about longevity, and apparently, drinking a lot of coffee is actually pretty good for you, and drinking alcohol is good for you in moderation.
I think you used the key phrase, moderation.
Yeah, you're not moderate in your coffee drinking. You're just going to live forever because you're just going to live forever, but not because of coffee. Like other people, they said it was like 2 to 3 cups, and I laughed because I don't drink any, and you drink 7,000 cups in a day, and I thought, well, if you split the two of us, we would live forever, but... But you are in significantly better shape than I am, which is why you will last a lot longer. But anyway, they also said, interestingly enough, they suggested that slightly elevated blood pressure was actually good for you when you're older. These are all people who are being studied in their 90s.
Yes.
And so it was a really cool kind of thing. And I thought, yeah, but like, if you have blood pressure, high blood pressure your entire life, that's probably not a good thing. So...
Again, that comes back to the key phrase, moderation.
Exactly. I don't do anything in moderation. Actually, that's not true. I do lots of things in moderation. Okay. So today we're gonna talk about I'd like to think of it as the last part of our first foray into the New Deal. I know that at some point we've got other topics that we wanna talk about within the New Deal, but this is the one that I find very exciting because it's sort of this. I didn't realize how controversial it was, and I want to get to that way at the end. But the first thing I want to start off by saying is we're going to talk about the TVA, right, which is the Tennessee Valley Authority.
That is correct.
And can I tell you what I know about the Tennessee Valley Authority?
Yes, please do.
Oak Ridge. That's it. That's all I know. I've read your notes, so now I know more. But until I read your notes, I really wasn't as familiar. I knew it was sort of I have this vague idea that it's a power thing, like it creates power. And yes. That's it, right? Like that's all I know. And I know that it was in the Appalachians because it runs along the Appalachian Mountains. But beyond that, I didn't really know until I was looking at your notes. So I'm excited for us to share all of this information with our, and by the way, Oak Ridge was where they made plutonium, uranium, one of the things that explodes atomic bombs, which I am, as chemists everywhere are wailing right now. I'm I think it's uranium now that I think about it, but it could be plutonium. Anyway, it's one of those things that you don't want to mess with because it will make you sick. But yes. They enriched that during the Manhattan Project, right, at Oak Ridge.
At the Oak Ridge facility in Tennessee, correct.
But that's not the main focus of TVA. It's just the thing that I remember it for.
Nia, your intro went ahead and like touched upon basically four or five of the major themes of the podcast episode.
Yay, go me! I made an abstract without trying. Okay.
Which was rather impressive because as you were speaking, I'm like, okay, well, she touched upon that. It's kind of sort of like the opening slide in a PowerPoint presentation. What we're going to talk about today, that was basically what you did in your intro.
Unintentionally, sorry there.
and I was just like, wow, the next time I do a PowerPoint slide presentation, I'm going to want Nia to put together that first slide right after the title slide, right? Because I always struggle with putting that one together, but you did an excellent job.
Ah, thank you.
So the TVA, as Nia pointed out, is another one of those New Deal programs.
Thank you, President Roosevelt.
Yep, it was definitely something that came from the Roosevelt administration. So the TVA is a federally owned electric utility corporation. So the first thing we should note about the TVA is that it is considered, as a type of government agency, it is considered a government corporation, meaning that it receives no taxpayer funding. It was created by the government, but it is supposed to be fully self-funding.
Oh, so like the post office or Amtrak, those kinds of things, although they aren't self-funding because they're holes into which money is thrown. Although the post office would be doing okay if it didn't have that weird thing where it has to fund its retirement out 400 years or whatever it is, like some ridiculous.
Yeah. So listeners, see our previous podcast episode about the United States Postal Service.
And our bitterness thereof.
Yeah. The United States Postal Service is the only corporation in the United States that is required by law to have on hand enough cash to cover current and future retirement liabilities. It's the only corporation, right?
Now, that's not saying that that's a terrible idea for all corporations, because then people would be guaranteed of their retirement.
Yes.
But it does cause you to often run in the red.
Yes. Now, Amtrak. But
anyway.
Amtrak is.
Amtrak's a whole different animal. It's just.
TVA, unlike those other two, has been historically profitable.
Okay.
And when we discuss the full scope of the TVA, I think, Nia, most of our listeners will understand why it's been so so profitable over the years.
So Tennessee Valley Authority is a misnomer, right? It's not just Tennessee.
Okay, but it covers a geographical region of the United States.
Right.
Known as the Tennessee Valley.
Okay.
Okay. But the Tennessee Valley, okay, includes not only basically the most of the state of Tennessee, but it also covers other parts of the country, including small areas of Virginia, North Carolina, and Georgia. But it has larger portions of Alabama, Mississippi, and Kentucky. So basically, folks, for those of you who might know the Appalachian Mountain region of the United States, it covers a big chunk of the southern half of the Appalachian Mountain region in the United States. But more specifically, you know, if you were born and raised there, you would know, you know, this is the Tennessee Valley area. Okay.
And side note, for anybody who is wondering about the pronunciation, those are the Appalachian Mountains as pronounced by them, and Appalachian as pronounced by everybody else. So if you go with the local pronunciation, we pronounce it Appalachian, and that I yes. say we because I am from the foothills of Appalachia in North Carolina. But I think most people know the Appalachian Trail. That's what they think of when they think of the long hike. And it goes from Alabama to Maine or something, some incredibly, I'm going to walk a trillion miles from here to there and eat lobster and then walk home or whatever. But this is a middle chunk of that.
Yes.
Southern chunk of that, really.
Yeah, southern.
A little bit of the middle.
A little bit of the middle. But Nia, as you pointed out, it was created by the United States Congress in 1933 at the request of the Roosevelt administration. There is actually a law, and we'll put this in the research guide, the Tennessee Valley Act, okay? Its initial purpose was quite broad. I mean, it was supposed to provide navigation, flood control, generate electricity, manufacture fertilizer, regional planning, and economic development in the Tennessee Valley. EnEA, okay, why was the United States Congress at the request of FDR so interested in doing all that stuff in the Tennessee Valley?
One, the Tennessee River was traditionally used for navigation and yes, trade. So it was known to people, like, so you're not building a thing that's not, that doesn't already exist and isn't already used for that. But I'm assuming because of the crushing poverty that, yes, the Appalachians experienced, not just then, but pretty much like up until the, this fixed some of it, but like some of it lasted into the 50s and 60s. And some, yes, parts of Appalachia even now are crushingly poor, and have little access to healthcare, little access to services that most people who live in less rural areas think of as quote unquote normal, right? There are some real pockets in the, even still in the Appalachians that are not connected to other.
By any number areas. Of measures, yeah, by any number of measures, there are still pockets of the Tennessee Valley that compare rather poorly to the rest of the country. So, mm-hmm. So I'm going to talk about today, and then I'm going to go back to what the conditions were when the TVA was proposed.
But even
today, Nia, okay. In terms of educational attainment, the Tennessee Valley ranks quite low.
Employment.
In terms of employment, general public health.
Life expectancy.
Life expectancy.
Which is quite low, I think, relative to everybody else.
To the other parts of the country. Even something like the digital divide. The Tennessee Valley, you know, struggles in regards to access to broadband, the internet. In many ways, it's always been a part of the United States that has been shut off to the rest of the country.
And part of it is physical isolation, right?
It is a difficult terrain to navigate.
Right. It's remote.
Yes.
And so there's that. That's part of it. And part of it is, and I do not mean this pejoratively, please don't, listeners, if you're from Appalachia, I love y'all. But those communities are often insular, in the sense that they do not want outsiders, they do not like outsiders, and they do not welcome outsiders. If you have not lived there for 200 years, if your family's not from the area, you are immediately met with suspicion. In yes. one of our previous episodes, we talked about librarians visiting those areas. It took a while for people to warm up to the book ladies. Like, they weren't sure about these people because traditionally, outsiders have meant trouble. And yes. so they just tend to be rather self-isolating in many instances, intentionally so. They don't want a lot of outside intervention.
And a number of scholars have chronicled that those first settlers in the Appalachians and in the Tennessee Valley specifically, were folks who did not like government. So they moved
and still are.
Yes. And they moved to very remote areas in the hopes that they basically would be left alone. And that's part of their culture. But in the 1930s, particularly during the Great Depression, this was an area that, even compared to the suffering, you know, in the general population, the Tennessee Valley was really hard hit.
Well, part of it too hadn't they sort of depleted soil in the, like, they were starting to see crop yields drop and things like that, right? Because of poor farming practices.
Yes.
And that sort of thing, which was hurting them, like, even for raising food for themselves.
Yes.
Let alone to sell.
Nia, you're correct. Almost all the research that I did mentioned that the Tennessee Valley, much of the land had been exhausted because of poor farming practices. So the soil was eroded and depleted. Crop yields had fallen. So farm incomes plummeted.
And as a side note on that, sorry if you don't mind me interrupting, crop rotation is a modern concept. Like, yeah, that was not, people didn't rotate their crops for, Jefferson did, because Jefferson understood, like, he experimented. He was a scientist. He was also highly educated. And he experimented a lot with Monticello, but most farms, that's not how they ran. You just had two fields, and one year you might plant two, and one year you might plant one, but you didn't rotate in other crops that would help reinvigorate the soil. Like, they didn't know any of that, so they didn't do any of that, which...
In crop rotation, and I've tried to explain this to students, crop rotation requires a certain amount of wealth. Because when you're rotating crops, either you're bringing in new crops, which requires a capital investment, or you're basically setting aside parts of your land to not be used. So that requires you to have some wealth, some savings, because you're basically taking out of rotation for a year, you know, a growing season or two or three, land that you would otherwise use.
That's an excellent point.
Okay. So, yep, you know, Jefferson could do that.
Because, you know, he had a lot of money.
Yeah, he had money. But for, you know, poor, you know, farmers in the Tennessee Valley, okay, what, you know, what they grew not only fed their family and their livestock, okay, but it was their source of income. So if you took out, you know, a part of your land from use, it was going to cut into your income.
Yeah. People are, if you say to them, you're going to go 3/4 time, they're kind of like, ooh, I get time back. And then they're, and then you say, you're also going to get 3/4 pay. They're like, whoa, wait, what? Because, yeah, yeah, right. Like, ooh, yeah, I get to do less work. Oh, but wait, I get less money. Right. Those, yeah, things go hand in hand. So, yeah,
this is also an area that is heavily forested. But
what I think was
because
heavily forested, maybe your,
you know, the best timber had been cut. And again, we now know this, and we see this with some regularity with the forest fires out west. You cut the best timber, and what you're left with is timber that is very susceptible to fires, right? Okay. So, and you were seeing that with some regularity in the Tennessee Valley.
So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
But also, you know, you and I have also mentioned public health concerns. Tennessee Valley had a malaria infection rate during the early years of the Great Depression of 30%. 30% of the residents of the Tennessee Valley had malaria.
3 in 10 people.
Yes.
And we're not talking about Panama. We're talking about Tennessee.
We're talking about Tennessee. You know, we're, right? We're like, talking, you know, in, you know, in the guts of the country.
Yeah, not where you would expect to get malaria. In the United States, like, most people don't think malaria, I'll go to the United States and get malaria, right? Like, that's not a, I think most visitors don't think that's probable. And when you think about 30%, that's enormous. And then you think about the treatments that it involves, and poor people, like, It's just a horrible cycle of.
Yeah. And again, this is a population that is very skeptical of outsiders.
Right.
So, if public health, and if officials were coming in, I mean, we see this even today in regards to, doctors and medical staff going into sparsely populated areas in developing countries. They're not trusted. They're an outsider. Okay. You want me to,
they brought this disease with them. That's what happens in people's minds is
yes.
You're here to fix the disease. Oh, you must have brought the disease because those two things happened at the same time.
Right?
And so in people's minds, they become conflated. And what you see in a lot of third world countries is I won't take your vaccine because it's giving people the sickness.
Yes.
As opposed to it's I'm here because I'm trying to prevent more spread of the sickness.
Yes.
So you see that a lot in people who are like, I don't know about this trust thing. But can we, though? So Roosevelt looks across the nation in the Depression, and he's like, this is bad. This is really bad. We need to have all kinds of programs to help people, and we need to put people to work and that sort of thing. So he says, and in the Tennessee Valley, we need economic development, right? We need to do something that will help spark.
Well, it was not only that, Nia, there was also a growing movement in the country in regards to the government being responsible for electricity. Because as you know, one of the large issues in the 1920s and into the 1930s was that many utility companies were privately held by the private sector, right?
Because electricity is a commodity that you can sell.
It was a commodity, right? And that was in conflict with the fact that, most of us need electricity.
Right.
Right? So is this a public good or is this a private good? And, we could have a debate about this, but that's one of the core debates, among economists and whether or not the government should regulate something. Is this a public good, which should be protected for everybody in the public? Or is this a private good, a commodity? If you use more, you pay more, right? If I'm a company that has sunk investment costs, and providing the source of the electricity, the distribution of the electricity, should I not be able to charge what the market will bear? So this was becoming a huge issue, particularly with the Depression, right? You have all these people who are losing their homes, their land, they can't put food on the table. But we had these privately held utility companies that weren't lowering their rates. So Roosevelt comes into office and says, I have this severely economically depressed area of the country. And the government needs to push back against all of these privately held utility companies. And this is an area, the Tennessee Valley, that has access to water.
Right? Hydropower.
Hydropower, right? Okay. And the solution, was the Tennessee Valley Authority Act.
We will bring electricity to the region. We will bring power generation to the region, which will also help with economic development, right? Because if there's power generation, then a company that makes steel can build a plant because, and then they will employ local people because there's power to, if there's no power to where you live, then a company can't build a company there because they can't build anything unless they build stuff by hand with wooden tools. So unless it's an Amish company, you're not going to see a lot of companies or corporations going where there's no power. Similarly, they will not go where there's no water. This would have both, right? It would have power, it would have water, because almost every industrial process also requires a fair bit of water.
Yes.
So that's why you don't see lots of huge companies out in the deserts. You see a few, and they are often run by solar power in an attempt to, right, because that's a strength of the desert. Yes. But they also are what I call dry industries. They're industries that don't require water in order to make something.
That's right. But at that point in U.S. history, okay, that's a few years down the road.
Right.
What we do know, you know, what was known at that time was, if you have a source of water, and a large population that increasingly was underemployed. Well, the thinking of the Roosevelt administration was, this is an opportunity for a grand experiment, right? We don't have to rely upon the private sector to provide the, you know, the utility, right?
Because the private sector looks at that and says, that's a great opportunity, but the upfront cost is going to be enormous,
right?
And most companies are not willing to go to their board of directors and say, hear us out. We'd like to spend $6 trillion. I know that's going to put us in debt for the next 10 years, but it's going to turn out really well, we think, right? Like, the board of directors is going to be like, get out of here, bozo. Like, that's not how companies work.
Yeah, what is the guaranteed return on the investment?
Right.
Okay. And building a power plant in the Tennessee Valley
might have worked out, but it might not have worked out.
Certainly didn't offer a guaranteed return on the investment.
Exactly.
Right? But the Roosevelt administration was like,
we're the government. We can do that.
We're the government. We can do this.
We build stuff all the time that doesn't work out.
Right. Okay. So almost immediately, I mean, within a year, the Tennessee Valley Authority was employing 9,000 people. 9,000 people, right?
9,000 locals.
Locals.
They did have some people that they brought in, right, from like for administrative positions
or
from other places, because you need experts.
Yeah, you know, experts in regards to hydropower, a lot of agricultural experts. They brought in a lot of people from the Department of Agriculture to basically reteach the farmers how to farm.
Or better farming practices, let's say.
Okay. Well, hey, in some cases, you're basically telling, you know, family farmers who generationally have been doing the same thing for three or four generations, yeah, the way you've been doing it is wrong, which didn't necessarily always go over well, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry, outsider. I can't hear you over the sound of yelling, get off my land.
Okay. But they also, you know, taught, you know, foresters, okay, how to do it better for the land. They also planted
how
a
to
whole
not
bunch
clear
of trees.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. They planted a whole bunch of trees. Okay.
Cool.
And once they developed, okay, the power, guess what?
Wait, I want to ask you a quick question before you get into what I think is going to be the next cool thing that I'm also interested in. Where was the headquarters of the TVA?
Initially, it was Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Okay.
Do you know what else is in Muscle Shoals, Alabama? Oh, so many things. I'm adding a very open-ended question, but I'll bet you know.
Well, I mean, for me, and I don't know if you're doing this on purpose, it is the home of some excellent blues music.
That's right. Okay. It's okay. The Muscle Shoals recording studio brought in the greatest names in music in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s to record there. And stuff that Rolling Stone said that it changed their lives to go to the to go to the Muscle Shoals recording studio. I can't remember which one. There are several recording studios there, but yeah, that's where of that comes out of. Just anyway, I think it's cool that they put it there, but then they eventually moved it right to Knoxville.
They moved it to Knoxville, Tennessee. Okay. Yep.
Which makes sense from an administrative point of view. Knoxville is more centralized than Muscle Shoals.
And you have the University of Tennessee there.
Right.
If you've ever been to Knoxville, I mean, it is a good sized city in Eastern Tennessee. Yes, I've been there a number of times, particularly for college football games, which, you know, their stadium holds well over 100,000 people.
Oh, are you kidding me? Their stadium is like what religious sites are for.
Oh, I mean,
for religious people. That's a football religion place. Yes. Like you go there and you're like, ah, because it's
Saturday night. Okay. In Knoxville.
Yeah. What do you mean you're doing something other than going to the football game? What's wrong with you?
Yes.
Oh, you're staying home and watching the football game on TV. Oh, okay. Right. Like that you don't have a choice. But anyway, I thought it'd be nice to mention Muscle Shoals to folks.
Yes.
So these things come together, water, and we build a hydro dam, and now we have power, and we get.
Well, then you start getting like a whole bunch of other industries.
I was going to say, it should be a crazy amount of industry, right?
Okay, well, this goes back to your point, right? All of a sudden now you start seeing textile plants. And again, these are textile plants that for nearly a generation and a half provided jobs in the Tennessee Valley. Now, many of them are now where?
Oh, I'm assuming Bangladesh and Thailand.
Yeah, they're overseas. Yeah, they've been outsourced, right?
But another company that was there.
Go ahead.
Alcoa. Yep. If anybody doesn't know what Alcoa is an aluminum company.
Yes.
And aluminum takes a huge amount of water and a huge amount of power to make. Like,
yes.
Aluminum is a very resource intensive industry.
And it produces a product that lasts forever. And
is in everything. Like,
it's in everything. And the United States kind of sort of rose to the forefront of the nations of the world in producing high quality aluminum products. It was amazing how this all came together. Okay. But I mean, Nia, within a decade, there were 12 hydroelectric plants, one coal-fired steam plant, just in terms of construction, they had hired 28,000 people.
Which is exactly what it needed to do. Like It changed the region in terms of, I mean, yes, they're still crushing poverty in pockets of the region, but the vast majority of that region has been lifted out of poverty basically due to this, the floor that Roosevelt put underneath it. But it's not all good, is it?
No.
Before we get to that, can I ask you though about the board of directors? Because you have an interesting note in here.
Yes.
About the board of directors of the TVA. So the board of directors they're nominated by the president and then confirmed by the Senate. But what I think is interesting in your notes is that a minimum of 7 of the directors are required to be a resident of the service area.
Yes.
So you can't just be living in California and be appointed to the board of directors of the TVA. You have to be directly affected by the decisions you make
Yes.
And the things that you do on the board. I really like that. I really think that that's, it's an important check or balance on the idea of we'll just play around, because Enron did all kinds of crazy stuff with the utility in California, and they didn't live in California.
Yes.
They lived in New York. So they weren't affected by the brownouts and the rolling blackouts and the this and the that of it. None of that bothered them.
And this is, not only is it a check, but it's also a way to get buy-in. I mean, think about it.
Excellent point.
7 out of the 9 directors have to be residents of the service area. So how better to go ahead and get buy-in than to go ahead and guarantee slots on the board, for in many cases, local elites. But if the local elites are willing to go ahead and serve on the board, might this not be a good thing for the Tennessee Valley?
Well, and it also prevents that sort of parachute in from Washington.
Yes.
Do a thing regardless of what the local population wants, needs, or cares about, and then parachute back out. Well, you don't parachute out. I don't know how you extract.
But the logic is spot on there, right? I would actually like to see that with more federal government boards, governing boards, right?
I would too.
Okay.
You have to be somebody who's got skin in the game, as it were.
Yes.
If we're going to talk football.
Yeah, exactly.
Got to have,
yes.
If you live there and whatever you're going to do is going to cause rolling brownouts and they're going to happen at your house too, you may have a whole different point of view about that than you would if it's going to happen to some other guy somewhere else, right? Like everybody here is going to feel the pain. Oh, well, maybe I don't like this pain nearly as much now.
And if you're from the area, you might be able to go ahead and pause and say, hey, wait a minute here. This is going to affect, the folks this way. And I know it will, because I was born here. I was raised here. I went to school here, right?
Okay. I know the ins and outs.
Okay. I'm hearing from farmers, this is what they need or what they don't need. Will textile jobs be good? Will, aluminum manufacturing jobs be good? But when they brought Alcoa there, that's when the federal government started thinking, hey, wait a minute. If this particular industry can thrive in the Tennessee Valley, what other projects we seem to be working on during World War II that is energy dependent might need significant amounts of water, and draws upon the same kind of scientific knowledge.
But you know what I think is also interesting about Oak Ridge is, interesting about the Manhattan Project in general, because part of it also took place in Eastern Washington state. And that is the idea that these are relatively, at the time, they're not now, but at the time were relatively remote.
Yes.
Like the likelihood of being spied on, being caught, having anybody figuring out what you're doing. Like now we think, sure, I could drive over to the Tennessee. Of course you could. You can drive over to Eastern Washington. But getting through the pass at from Western Washington to Eastern Washington back in the day was not a simple thing. That was a long, drawn out, complicated process. And you had to do it at the right time of the year or you weren't going to get through. So,
and for our enemies, logically, it makes no sense to go ahead and build an atomic weapons plant in the middle of nowhere, right? I mean, again, think logically of your enemies. Because your enemies would go ahead and assume, well, it's got to be built somewhere where there is a lot of knowledge and technical expertise, et cetera, et cetera. So it's probably going to be close to government agencies or colleges and universities, because you need a lot of smart people, right?
You could just pick them up and take them to Tennessee, plop them down and say, go to it.
So, you know, logically, it's just like, hey, you know, nothing's going on here. It's Tennessee Valley. Nothing happens here, right? It's economically depressed. We're not, hey, Ma, nothing's going on here.
That's right. Nothing to see. Move along.
Right. Okay.
The other good thing is that if you're in an area like that and weirdos, strangers show up, you'll be like, who's that guy? What's he here for? Right. Yes. Strangers will stand out more. So it's an interesting thing of a confluence of events that came together. But I do, it sounds to me, and I'm betting one of your objections or one of the things you're going to mention as an objection, because they're not your objections. You were not alive then. You did not object to this. But I'm guessing one of the objections at the time would have been, this sounds like commie socialism, pinko, government intervention, and the market rules, and what's wrong with you people?
Yeah.
Am I right that that's one of the
the
objections?
The existing private utility industry had some strong objections because they thought that the provision of electricity was a private good. It was a commodity that the government should not be involved. That if Americans wanted cheaper electricity, they would indicate their desires in the marketplace and the industry would respond accordingly. So that was one objection. Then this whole idea that the federal government would be a jobs creator. I mean, come on now. I mean, you know, in capitalism, the government is not supposed to be a jobs creator. Okay.
Same argument for the WPA, which is
I mean
the market prevails.
Yeah, right. So we have an economic downturn, a rather severe one, but we have an economic downturn known as the Great Depression. Eventually, though, those with wealth will reinvest. They will produce goods and services that the public will want. They will have to hire more people to produce those goods and services, and the marketplace will return. So, you know, this whole idea that the government, would create one, get into the power producing business, you know, the production of electricity, was a problem. But then two, the fact that the Roosevelt administration was never shy. The TVA was going to be an economic development engine for this depressed area of the country. So this violated, you know, all kinds of capitalist principles, and this has got to be socialism. And, you know, why aren't you letting the market respond? So there's the economic theoretical.
Now,
then
can
they
we side note something? By 1933, we are 4 years into this depression.
Yes.
I mean, we're 4 years into people struggling, right? Because Hoover didn't do anything.
Yeah.
Hence Hoovervilles. Hoover was the market will correct, the market will correct. He kept saying the market will correct itself, and it kept getting worse and worse and worse because the market was not correcting itself. Proof that capitalism occasionally needs a goose, right? It needs to be goosed. It needs to be.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, if you think about the Marxian critique of capitalism, eventually the worker class will revolt against the owner class. But, you know, what Marx could not have foreseen was how many Western democracies would interject safety nets and laws and regulations that mitigate the worst outcomes of capitalism. You know, that's where you get the phrase or the concept of regulated capitalism, right? We don't allow capitalism to engage its worst tendencies or pathologies. We try to mitigate or soften, the worst externalities of the market.
So that the people don't overthrow the overlords.
Yeah, there you go, right?
It's in people, it's in the wealthiest best interest to have a safety net.
Yes.
To prevent the rocky ground from forcing people.
Yeah, to allow the occasional government foray into.
Now we've moved into classes and Marxist theory, and we should move back out of that because you and I could talk about that for 4 or 5 or 10 episodes.
Yeah, we should probably go ahead and wrap up with a couple other trenchant criticisms.
Right.
Okay, first of all, and this was a big one, and even advocates of the TVA or supporters of the TVA have recognized that this was a huge problem. The TVA was given authority in law to use eminent domain. And for our listeners who don't know this, this basically means that the government has the authority to take private property and use it for quote unquote public use.
And they have to pay you what's quote unquote market value.
Yeah, just compensation. Yes.
But I'm going to argue that in this particular instance, market value of dirt that is completely worthless probably wasn't very high.
High.
So they probably didn't pay a huge amount to these farms when they took them.
According to some scholars, over 125,000 Tennessee Valley residents were displaced by the agency.
I mean, just right, we should note that one of the things that they did when they built dams was they built reservoir, like it backs up the reservoir, it builds a reservoir. And when you build a dam and you make a reservoir, you flood the area behind that. Well, if that's where people live, then you have to move those people and you have to buy their farms and you have to move them off that property so that you can flood that land and you can't just flood land and kill people like that. Yes. I know the government probably occasionally wants to do that, but they can't because that's not cool. But the other thing is, right, you also have all of the attendant buildings that have to go along with supporting that along the river. And so those properties would have also been taken as well. So yes. 15,000 families, I think you said.
Yeah, 15,000 families, over 125,000 residents. And by the way, at least initially, its first couple decades of existence, the TVA didn't go about this nicely.
A guy just showed up and said, hey, you're going to need to get off this land.
They went to court.
Oh, okay.
And by the way, folks, I'm completely shocked. Me and I forgot to mention this. The TVA actually has its own police department.
Oh, that's right.
Yes.
They have the
their own law enforcement agency.
Many private entities they have.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm sure they showed up to remove people from a farm. Those people said, we're not going. And they said, okay, well, here's a lawsuit. And by the way, if you are so dirt poor that your dirt doesn't produce anything, you're not going to be able to fight that in court.
No.
Like they're going to bring a lawsuit and you're going to capitulate because there's no way that you can afford to fight.
Also, the TVA had no problem, okay, flooding historic Native American sites, including burial sites, and many early American Revolution era settlements.
It's gone.
Gone.
Underwater.
Yes. And by the way, for those of you who are wondering, when the TVA was challenged in federal court, the United States Supreme Court in the case of Ashwander versus the Tennessee Valley Authority said that the United States Congress, using what authority, Nia?
In your notes, it says under the War Powers Clause.
But there was one other you need to read up earlier.
Sorry, missing it.
the court noted that regulating commerce among the states.
Oh, the Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause. I think it's interesting, War Powers Clause. I guess that's the war on the Depression.
No. The Supreme Court was actually basically trying to give the federal government multiple bullets in its gun by mentioning the War Powers Clause. Okay.
Although Commerce Clause really makes the most sense. You're talking about several states.
Yes.
You're talking about the delivery power across that. And I should have known because it's your favorite.
Okay. Well, it's not necessarily my favorite, but it's the, hey,
it's when the overriding doubt, clause.
I tell my students, and I told.
If you're in a law student, for all the law students who are listening to this, if you're in a class and somebody says, what's your constitutional basis for that? Just lead with the Commerce Clause.
Commerce Clause.
And make them disprove you. Because you're going to be right 99.4% of the time.
I mean, particularly in the period between 1937 and like the early 1990s, right?
Yeah, you just say Commerce Clause and say it all derisively, like they should know that. When they say, what's your authority? You say, Commerce Clause.
The Commerce Clause.
And then take a drink of your beer and walk off like,
right?
And then make them wonder about their life choices. I'm just saying.
But one of the other interesting things that should be noted is the Roosevelt administration's arguments in federal court during this period of time, they started using war powers. And this was before the United States was even in World War II, right?
This is before World War II was even in World War II. 1936?
Yeah, right?
Was it? I don't know if Poland was invaded in...
What, 37?
Yeah.
Right? Okay, so Nia's looking that up.
Yep.
Yeah. When did Germany invade Poland?
39. Okay. Oh,
39, right?
Yeah, I was like 30. Yeah.
39. So we're a couple years out, right? Okay.
Right.
But the Roosevelt administration was already beginning to use that as a justification. Okay. Which I was just like, wow.
Well, and I mean, anybody who thinks that the war on terror isn't the same thing, like,
yes,
that's exactly, I mean, presidents discover a war, quote war. Nixon had his war on drugs. Okay. and then you can do all kinds of stuff justified under that,
because generally, as we discussed in a previous podcast episode, one of the rules of justiciability is the political questions doctrine. And what, in one of the cases that is considered a quote-unquote political question that the Supreme Court typically won't get involved with is decisions about war.
Right. That's up to the, it's up to Congress.
Yeah, right.
Who often takes that ball and punts it over to the White House. Right.
So, I mean, but so, yeah.
I think big criticism that you have listed here that I'd like to mention before we round out the episode is sort of the discrimination aspect of this. Something that we need to keep in mind in this time period, African Americans had little to no rights. Women of either, or well, of any, I should say, any race, because it also included Native American women as well, had absolutely no rights, practically. They had the right to vote, but that's it. So they would have been... they were not hired in great numbers. Women were not hired in very many numbers at all. Now, what's interesting is that the textile plants that came along as a result of this hired lots of women.
Women, yes.
So, but we still have a problem with folks of color finding jobs.
The Tennessee Valley jobs were segregated.
Yeah.
Segregated by race, segregated by gender, right? And they were well into the 1970s, Nia. Right.
Right. I saw in here that you said in 1987 they settled a lawsuit.
Yes.
Like in 1987, people. That's
87. Yes.
That is, 50 years after the thing started.
Yes.
I guess we ought to get around to treating people equally. Yeah, maybe that would be a good idea, Chucklehead. But so that is a thing that one has to keep in mind. However, I would like to end on a positive note, if we could.
Yes.
Which is that the TVA recognized unions.
Yes,
and that's that was not hugely common in giant corporations, right? Like, I don't know if Ford's folks were unionized, but I would bet if they were, it wasn't much. So yes. You know what I mean? So unions, yes.
It was a big deal, and it actually was part of the criticism that the TVA was quote unquote socialist and communist.
Right, because they agreed that unions should have that there should be some power.
You know, of collective the bargaining. Yes. Right. And I was...
So yeah, maybe a negative that's also a positive. Hey, thanks, Augie. Thanks for talking to me about this.
Oh, hey, this is great. Love the discussion. And as Nia mentioned, listeners, in the future, we might pull on a couple more strings that are part of the New Deal.
Cool. So, thank you.
All right. Thank you.
You've been listening to Civil Discourse, brought to you by VCU Libraries. Opinions expressed are solely the speaker's own and do not reflect the views or opinions of VCU or VCU Libraries. Special thanks to the workshop for technical assistance. Music by Isaac Hobson. Find more information at guides.library.vcu.edu/discourse. As always, no documents were harmed in the making of this podcast.